Okay, let's start. Now, the title of this lecture is A Very Special Relationship, Hollywood and the Germans. That title actually I used for, in relation to other publications that I've had to do with this topic. And in some ways, this very special relationship is not what my lecture is all about. I didn't know this at the time I gave this title to Anna and Petter, but I thought it was a nice title, but it's not actually what this lecture is about. If you do want to know what the special relationship is, I guess it has two elements. One, that while it's usually said that Hollywood was founded by Central and Eastern European Jews, which is correct, one also has to regard that many of those Eastern European and Central European Jews were actually German speakers and were assimilated Jews, which means they actually saw themselves not necessarily primarily as Jews, but they saw themselves primarily as Germans or Austrians. So there's a very special relationship, which is quite curious if you think about it, between the founders of Hollywood and Germany. And it's not that surprising because although we always hear about the Irish and the Italian and the Jewish immigrants to Europe, to the United States, by far the largest immigrant group in 19th century America was Germans, and mostly Christian Germans, but also quite a few Jewish Germans. So that's one part of the special relationship. And once you start thinking about that, you then can see the whole history of Hollywood in a different way. Because what you realize is that many of the top people working in Hollywood from the 1910s onward, so not just the studio founders, but a lot of the top directors, writers, actors in Hollywood were actually of German or Austrian origin. So, you know, probably the most consistently successful director in Hollywood across the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and into the 70s, was a Jewish German from the Elsass called William Wyler. And there's many, many other examples where you can actually demonstrate that the presence of German speakers, people born in Germany or Austria, in Hollywood is absolutely amazing until the 1970s. They all die out in the 1970s, or they stop working in Hollywood. There's a couple of curious exceptions. One is the head of Gulf and Western, Charlie Bluedorn, who had nothing to do with Hollywood, but he happened to be an Austrian immigrant who happened to take over Paramount and run it as his personal fiefdom. So you have these curious exceptions, but the founding fathers of Hollywood and the waves and waves of immigrants from Germany, professional migrants from Germany, that dominated large segments of Hollywood until the 70s, that comes to an end. And then we have a whole new wave. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about a new wave of people, especially two people that I want to concentrate on, Roland Emmerich and Wolfgang Petersen. The other phrase, the other use of the phrase a special relationship, a very special relationship, simply has to do with what I already mentioned in the previous lecture, is that Hollywood invested untold billions of dollars. German investors put untold billions of dollars of money into Hollywood from the late 90s until, I guess, today, so that virtually no Hollywood production over the last 15 years or so has done without substantial German finance. But that's neither here nor there, because these investors had no influence on Hollywood decision-making. So there are different ways in which you can think about a very special relationship between Hollywood and the Germans, but I'm actually not going to go into those very much at all. So let me step back a little bit from some of the things I've talked about today and put it into the context of some academic debates. You know, why do academics get heated about some of the things I've touched on so far in my lectures? For almost a century, scholars in a range of disciplines, as well as American and non-American film industry representatives, politicians, and cultural commentators, have been debating the relationship between Hollywood and the world, well, Hollywood and the world beyond the borders of the United States. Now, non-American film audiences have played a twofold role in these debates. On the one hand, there's the assumption that Hollywood exports have long been very successful in cinemas and later also on television, video and DVD around the world. And that therefore, Hollywood has played an important part in the life of non-American film audiences, exerting various kinds of cultural and ideological influence on them, which are often subsumed under the heading Americanization. So that's one way in which this whole debate about Hollywood and the rest of the world, and especially non-American audiences configured, they're somehow being Americanized because Hollywood films are also wonderfully successful all around the world. So they Americanize the audiences. On the other hand, precisely because Hollywood's successful exports have generated a considerable share of the industry's overall income, the film preferences and objections of non-American audiences, the latter often mediated through censorship boards and other official organizations in particular countries, can in turn be assumed to have played an important part in the operations of Hollywood. So if Hollywood exerts this influence on audiences, it's also dependent on those audiences. Hollywood is dependent on the income generated by non-American audiences. If these audiences have particular preferences or particular objections, and if particular censorship boards in these countries, particular political organizations, will actually protest against what Hollywood does on behalf of these non-American audiences, then you can see that non-American audiences might have a strong influence on Hollywood. Yeah, so it's a two-way street. It's not just Hollywood influencing non-American audiences, but non-American audiences might actually influence what Hollywood does. Now, as Josef Dankert has pointed out, the discussion of Hollywood's success around the world has traditionally relied on figures relating to supply. Yeah, so all the debates you read about Hollywood's success around the world, they usually have to do with supply. How many of the films released in a particular country come from Hollywood? Rather than demand, which means how many of the tickets sold for films in this country were sold for Hollywood films. Yeah? And that's a crucial difference. Because as Gankert's analysis of the German market shows, across much of the 20th century, Hollywood's often dominant share of film supply, most of the films in the market, or at least half, came from Hollywood. This rarely translated into an equivalent share of demand. Most of the tickets sold were for Hollywood films. Indeed, before the 1980s, in countries such as West Germany, France, Italy, the UK, and Japan, Hollywood's share of box office revenues and ticket sales tended to be less than 50%, with the majority of revenues going to domestic productions, films made in that country, and to imports from neighboring countries. So in the 50s, for example, the most important imports in Germany did not come from Hollywood, they came from Austria. Yeah? And similarly, I believe in the Netherlands, for example, in, despite the war, that the most important, most successful imports came from Germany rather than the United States in the 50s in the Netherlands. So it's neighboring countries, it's cultural similarity which determines the success of imports from abroad rather than Hollywood's dominant presence by being able to release all these films in a country. That until the 70s in most major markets, in most big countries, well, I shouldn't say big countries, in most medium-sized countries in Europe and in Asia, it actually did not translate, this ability to put films into the market did not actually translate into a dominance of ticket sales for these films, for these American imports, these Hollywood imports in those countries. I'm not going into the whole thing that, as I said earlier, in the 50s and 60s, most Hollywood films were not actually in any meaningful way American. I'm not going to go into that issue right now. I'm trying to keep it quite simple by saying whatever Hollywood released, whether those are American or European films, they actually did not manage to dominate markets in terms of ticket sales in large European countries or in medium-sized world countries until the 1970s. That's quite important that we keep that in mind. Now, investigations of Hollywood's influence around the world have to take these limits of its success into account. You can't go on and on about how Hollywood films Americanized China or India or something, if you then find out that they were hardly ever seen, and if they were seen, they were only seen by very few people. You know, the whole argument about Americanization falls completely flat at that moment, because there was no audience, substantial audience, for these films in many countries around the world. Now, as I said in my previous lecture, this hasn't been researched properly, but the Josef Dankert's work on Europe, in particular West Germany, or Germany in general, strongly suggests that Hollywood has not been that successful in actually selling tickets on the basis of the many films it has released in all these different countries. Okay. Now, another thing I want to suggest to you is, since Hollywood isn't generally successful, you know, in all these countries around the world, it isn't generally actually releasing all these films until the 70s and 80s, which do translate their success in the United States into similar levels of success abroad, it becomes ever more important to concentrate on those few films with which Hollywood was actually successful. A key example in most of Europe would be Bridge on the River Kwai in the late 50s. You know, that was successful in the charts in many countries around Europe. Dr. Zhivago would be another example from the mid-60s, where you could say this film is not only, you know, one of the few films with which Hollywood has a hit in one country, but it actually is a hit in several countries around Europe, Western Europe initially, and then maybe you find similar patterns in Asia, for example, or in Anglophone countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and Britain. Okay, so when we think about Hollywood's influence abroad, we have to take into account how successful these films are. And then we have to concentrate on those films which are most successful, because then we can expect that those have exerted an influence, if there is any such influence at all. Now, we can also reverse the perspective. It is important to note that the influence audiences and their representatives around the world might be able to exert on Hollywood's output. Yeah, I said that if Hollywood is dependent on foreign markets, then those audiences abroad might have an influence on Hollywood. But that influence, of course, depends on how large the share of the money generated in that country, how large that share of that money is of Hollywood's overall income. Yeah, if the money generated in a particular country makes up only 1% of Hollywood's overall income, then we can't assume that whatever these people in this country do will make any difference to Hollywood whatsoever. And it's worth probably pointing out that's probably the situation with China until recently and India. That, you know, that's what, 2.3 billion people? They generate, you know, I don't know, 1 to 5% of Hollywood's income. Those 2.3 billion people, no matter what you read about the prospects of the Chinese market, it's really irrelevant for Hollywood right now. If they do anything with China or India, it's all for the future, for the distant future. But right now, probably Belgium is more important for them than the 2.3 billion people living in India and China. I'm exaggerating a little bit, so please don't quote me on that. Okay, so we need to look at the countries that actually generate Hollywood's income, because only those audiences in those countries might exert an influence on Hollywood. Furthermore, one might say, and that's actually true, that Hollywood's foreign, it's not just that it's a few countries which generate a large part of Hollywood's foreign income, it's actually a few films. I mean, the most extreme example is Avatar, which was 10% of overall world expenditure on films in 2010, and it made up, since Hollywood's share of overall earnings anywhere around the world from cinema tickets is 50%. So Avatar's share of Hollywood's income worldwide was actually 20%. So it's 20% of total income that Hollywood had, and I think it's probably more than 20% of its foreign income. So individual films can make up, it's not just that it's eight countries who make up 70 to 80% of all the export income from that Hollywood earns, but it's also, it could be, a single film could make up anywhere between 10 and 20%. And if you have three, four mega blockbusters in a year, that could be, I mean, I'm not sure, I haven't done the calculations, but it could be a third to a half of all the money that Hollywood earns around the world might come from only three, four films. Again, I might be exaggerating a little bit. I would have to, you know, do the figures more carefully. But I have to, you know, be a bit dramatic about this. And of course, that makes it important to study those films. Not the hundreds of others, you know, that may make some money. But here's a film that makes 10% of all of the export income for Hollywood in a given year. So I want to justify looking at hit movies once again, because they are so important. They generate so much income. I also want to alert us to the fact that in terms of commercial influence and cultural influence, most of the time we really have to concentrate on a few countries, because only in a few countries can we demonstrate since the 70s that Hollywood actually dominates ticket sales in those countries with its films. And those countries, as far as I'm aware, don't include the countries where the majority of the world population lives. Certainly not India, probably not China. I can't imagine that Bangladesh, Pakistan, Indonesia, that these people watch mainly Hollywood films. I think they mainly watch Bollywood films rather than Hollywood films, or domestic productions. But as there are no studies on this, you know, it's all speculation. Okay, so in the first part of this lecture, I want to provide a case study of one of Hollywood's biggest foreign markets, one of those eight markets that make up the vast majority of its income from abroad. So I want to compare German box office charts, the annual top 10, with their American counterparts. And I want to show that there are differences between the two. Yeah, even since the 70s, the German market is dominated by American imports. But nevertheless, there are very striking differences between the two charts. And some of those differences are the same as if you compared these two charts. Yeah? You could do a general comparison between America's biggest hits at home, Hollywood's biggest hits at home, Hollywood's biggest hits abroad. What I want to do is I want to, you know, compare the annual top 10 list in the United States with the annual top 10 list in Germany. Some of what I find out, you would find out if you did this comparison. But some of the differences are very specific to Germany. Yes, so some of the differences have to do with the difference between Hollywood and the rest of the world, or America and the rest of the world, or America and Canada and the rest of the world. And some of the differences are actually very specific to Germany. Now, the second section of my lecture, I will reverse the perspective, not what is Hollywood doing in Germany, which films are successful and what patterns can we find, but what are the Germans doing in Hollywood? So I'm going to look at Roland Emmerich and Wolfgang Petersen. And here I focus on the question whether these two filmmakers, this sounds ridiculous, but we'll see where it takes us, have brought anything specifically German to Hollywood. Yeah, do these two guys from Germany carry anything specifically German to Hollywood? But I also want to ask whether the Germanness of Petersen and Emmerich plays a role when their American films are shown in Germany. Yeah? Are the reviewers and the audiences in Germany aware that these are German filmmakers, and does that influence their reception of those international big-budget Hollywood films? Okay, so those are the two parts of my lecture. So the first part is called Hollywood Hits in Germany. Since the 1970s, and I have to talk about West Germany until 1991 and then Germany, so I can't always do the West. So whenever I say Germany, it's before 1991, it's West Germany, or 1990. When was it? 1990, sorry. Before 1990, it's West Germany, and then from 1990, it's Germany. Since the 1970s, Germany has been one of Hollywood's main sources of export revenues, making up around 10% of Hollywood's foreign box office. 10% Germany. So it's one of the largest foreign markets for the US, for Hollywood, sorry. The first thing to note about German box office charts is that until the early 70s, they were dominated by domestic productions, German-made films, in conjunction with Austrian imports in the 1950s and imports from other European countries, like France and Italy, in the 1960s. Hollywood imports only rose to a very prominent position in the charts across the 1970s and came to dominate the annual top 10 only in the 1980s. For the present purpose, it makes sense then to stick to the period that I've been working with so far, starting everything I do with 1997, roughly. You know, because it's the major turning point in the United States, and also it's a turning point in global hit patterns, and I'm going to stick to that when I talk about Germany, roughly. Now, comparing the annual top 10 hits on the one hand in West Germany, or the reunified Germany after 1990, with those in the US and Canada, reveals considerable overlap. So first of all, we have to note there is overlap. However, so some of the films which are in the top 10 in the United States and Canada are also in the top 10 in Germany. Not necessarily in the same year, because it might be released a year later. However, there are also striking differences. Most notably, the continuing presence of German productions and European imports in the German charts. Even though Hollywood dominates the charts in Germany, they continue to have, quite unlike the American charts, have German domestic productions still in the top 10 and European imports. And since the late 1970s, it's about one or two per year, on average. It's one or two German domestic productions or European imports per year. Following on from trends of the late 60s and the early 1970s, we can also note that certain kinds of American imports achieve much higher levels of success in Germany than in the domestic market. That's something you already notice in the late 60s, that certain kinds of American films have an astonishing success in Germany when they have no such success in America at all. This applies especially to erotic films. Because the German market completely was divided in the late 60s into the kinds of films that I and my mom went to, namely bad boy movies, but naughty schoolboys, and, you know, ganging up on their teachers and doing stuff, featuring pop star sensations like Heintje, the Dutch singer, and on the other hand, sex films. So the German market gets completely divided between sex films, mostly German-made, and these children's films. And in that context, the Germans did develop a habit of watching erotic movies. Not me. I was with the bad boys, bad school boys. But there was a substantial audience for erotic films. Now, after a few years, it wasn't just German-made films. It was more glamorous French-made films, like Emmanuel. But also American imports. So Mandingo, which is a kind of interracial sex and rape and passion type film. Never seen it, but I imagine that's what it is. Was the seventh highest grossing film in West Germany in 1975. I don't even know whether it was in the top 50 in the United States. Caligula, produced as a mixture of historical epic in the Ben-Hur mode and hardcore pornography. I always remember the story of a friend of mine, acquaintance of mine, fellow student of mine, who didn't know in the early 80s, when her parents came to visit, what to take her to the cinema to see with. And she decided that they used to go and see historical epics, you know, at the cinema. And there happened to be a historical epic at the cinema right now, but this was in Britain, and I think it was a heavily edited version. But nevertheless, she took her parents to see Caligula, and apparently it was a horrifying experience that she never wants to remember. Caligula, which did no business in the United States at all, was the fourth highest grossing film in Germany in 1980. The Blue Lagoon. Today you could go to prison to make a film like this or to watch it on your computer at home. I have never seen it, but presumably it's a pedophilic film about, you know, teenagers having sex on an island. I don't think it did big business in the United States, but it was the 10th highest grossing film in Germany in 1981. Yeah, so it's quite interesting that, this heavy investment in Germany in sex films, in erotic films, makes certain totally marginal films in the United States big hits, but only in Germany. The other interesting example is Disney. Disney actually, well, I come back to this division in Germany between sex films and children's films. So in the United States, children's films really become marginal in the charts from the late 60s onwards. In the Germany, they form one of the main genres. And one of the main genres within the children's film is the animated film. Now, these were not just American imports, because I grew up with, you know, Asterix and Obelix, French animated films. But also, of course, Disney films. So in the very period when traditional Disney productions, that means not the Touchstone label films, which Disney released, but films that Disney released under the Disney label, animated or live action, they disappear from American charts in the 70s and 80s. And that's really astonishing. However, in Germany, the company, Disney, placed on average one animated feature or live-action children's film per year in the top 10 between 75 and 88, taking often one of the two top positions. Robin Hood, not much business in the United States, second highest grossing film in Germany in 1975. The Rescuers, second highest grossing film in 78. The Jungle Book, not only was The Jungle Book one of the highest grossing films on its first release in 68 or so, and then again in the 70s, on its second release, it was one of the highest grossing films of the year of release. It was the highest grossing film in Germany in 1980, and the second highest grossing film in 1988. The Jungle Book probably was seen by far more people in German cinemas than any other film in history, because it was released as a top charting film four or five times across its lifetime, which isn't over yet. The Aristocats was the second highest grossing film in Germany in 1981. The Fox and the Hound, the highest grossing film in 1982. So the German box office charts in the late 70s and 80s, early 80s, are dominated by Disney at the time when Disney could not place any of its traditional animated or live-action Disney films in the American charts, or hardly any. Now, the strong preferences of West German audiences for animation, which was in evidence, as I mentioned, since the late 1960s, also supported Disney's rivals, who didn't have big hits in America. Notably, ex-Disney animator Don Bluth, whose film The Secret of Nim was the sixth highest grossing film in 1982, and The Land Before Time, which was the seventh highest grossing film of 1989 in West Germany, and they were much less successful in the US and Canada. Now, as I said, Germany makes up about 10% of the export market of the United States. The export market makes up about 50% of the overall income that Hollywood has. So the German market accounts for only 5%. So even though we might say that Disney was wiped out in the United States across the 70s and early 80s with its traditional productions, even the fact that it so dominated Germany in the late 70s, early 80s, in the global picture doesn't make that much difference, because that German market only makes up 5% of Hollywood's total income from around the world. But nevertheless, it's important to note that there's a radical difference in the way the American charts operate and the German charts around erotic films on the one hand and children's films, especially animated films, on the other. Now, after 1990, Hollywood animation is about as prominent in the German top tens as it is in the American and Canadian top tens. Although the animated films which make it into the respective top tens are not necessarily the same. The German preference for animation before the 1990s indicates that Hollywood animation can travel extremely well across national borders, while the variations, the differences found after 1990, confirm a general observation, which is that despite the fact that you think animation should travel most easily around the world, a lot of Hollywood films, if you look at the charts, a lot of Hollywood animated films do not actually replicate their success abroad. The reason is that they're not just animated, which is associated with a more abstract, more universalized, less culturally specific way of perceiving appropriate for children. There's not only that, but there are also comedies. And comedies don't travel well, usually. Yeah? So one of the reasons why you find, when you compare these two charts, that animated films often don't replicate their American success abroad has to do with the fact that they're comedies, and comedy doesn't travel just as well. But there are exceptions, and the German case is a very complicated case, as I try to outline. Okay, just like animated films, James Bond films were also much more successful in West Germany across the 70s and 80s than they were in the US and Canada, and that's of course a general pattern. If you look at the list here, the period 77 to 81, you have three Bond films in the top 10 for the export, but not for the domestic charts. In Germany, for the German market, we can see the same difference as there is between the general comparison that I'm alluding to. Bond films disappeared for over a decade from the domestic top 10s in the US after Octopussy in 1983. But they continue to generate top 10 hits in West Germany with Never Say Never Again in 1984, A View to a Kill, 1985, The Living Daylight, 1987, License to Kill, 1989. This is in line with what one would find, as I said, if one conducted a general comparison between the domestic and foreign charts on the handout. Now, an intriguing difference between the German and American-Canadian charts since the mid-1970s concerns films relating, not surprisingly, to the Nazi era and to war. Now, here's something very interesting. These kinds of films were very prominent in the American charts until the mid-60s, until 1970. Films which either had Nazis or covered any aspect of World War II. Actually, in fact, the last one that really succeeded in that vein, one of the last ones was Cabaret in the early 70s. But from the mid-70s onwards, these films are not very prominent in the American charts at all. But they are very prominent in Germany. And they're both American imports and German productions. So in 1977, the German top 10 had three of those films. The German documentary, can you imagine, a documentary in the annual top 10, Hitler, Eine Karriere, Hitler, a Career. The next film was Ingmar Bergman's Nazi drama, Das Schlangenei, The Serpent's Egg, which was a German-American co-production. And then there was an epic United Artists release called A Bridge Too Far, which was at the Bridge at Arnhem, I think. Was it Arnhem or Remagen? I can't remember now. So the three top 10 films related to the Nazis and World War II in 1977. After that massive impact of these kinds of films in 1977, a range of films about World War II and also about other wars. That's the funny thing. Once, you know, German audiences have confirmed their total obsession with Nazis and war, they then take any war. Yeah, so all these films that have to do with war suddenly become hugely successful in Germany. And quite surprisingly, a series of Vietnam movies become major hits in Germany. Apocalypse Now, number 6 in 79. First Blood, 7th in 1983. Rambo, First Blood Part 2, 4th in 85. Platoon, 6th in 1987. Full Metal Jacket, 1983. Now, while Apocalypse Now, Rambo 2, and Platoon also entered the American-Canadian top 10, the West German market, quite surprisingly, generated a larger number of top 10 hits about the Vietnam War than the US market. That is very baffling. I mean, this is the key political event in American post-war history, the Vietnam War. But the Germans, with their total obsession with the Nazi era and anything to do with war, generate a larger number of Vietnam hits in the top 10 than even the Americans. Another striking feature of the German top 10 is the outstanding success of romantic comedies and romantic dramas, which often took one of the top two spots when it wasn't a Disney film, in the annual charts from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s. While in the US and Canada, romantic dramas and romantic comedies rarely achieved these kinds of extremely high rankings. The high point of the reign of romance came with three West German productions. Again, three West German productions, not imports. The comedy Men, which was the top-grossing film of 86, and the two romantic farces featuring TV comedian Otto, So these are Otto the film, which is Otto the movie, which was the top grossing film in 85, and Otto der neue film, which is Otto the new movie. First, they're very inventive that way, aren't they? First in 1987. American imports profiting from this trend. Yeah, it's a German trend. It's a German taste formation, a German set of preferences, which can express itself through German films, but then also can take in imports. So American imports profiting from this trend included Out of Africa, the second highest grossing film of 1986, The Bodyguard, second in 1993, While You Were Sleeping, one of my personal favorites, second in 1994, while the success of Basic Instinct, which was the top grossing film in Germany in 1992, is a reminder of the German preference for sexually explicit material. It's one of the last ones. It performs much better at the German chart, in the German chart, than it does in the United States. While most of these Hollywood imports that I mentioned also featured in the American-Canadian top 10, they were ranked much lower. So they are much more successful comparatively in the chart in Germany than they were in the United States. Once again, these observations about the German market are in line with what you would find if you compared the domestic American-Canadian market with the rest of the world market. These differences, romantic dramas and romantic comedies, because they always tell you, oh, Hollywood makes action films because they play well in Asia, you know, where the people, you know, just want to see action, and also, you know, you don't need to understand the language, and that's why action films do so well. Well, that may be the case, but commercially speaking, Hollywood is most successful when you compare the genres between the United States and Canadian market and the rest of the world. The really striking difference is romantic drama and romantic comedy, which does better abroad. And there, of course, we have to take into account that romance is the importance, not the comedy. Comedy has difficulties traveling well, but romantic comedy has less difficulties traveling well because it's really about romance, not about comedy. And apparently romance is less culturally specific than is comedy. So these differences between the German and the American top 10, or the American-Canadian top 10 and the German top 10, these are all differences that we find in these general comparisons as well. But what we wouldn't find in these general comparisons, of course, is the German preference for German films. You know, you would not find that, you know, there's many German films in here, German-themed films or German-made films, which are more successful in the rest of the world or are as successful to make it into the top 10, which they could never make in the United States. And Schindler's List is an interesting exception. I'm going to come to that in a minute, or rather in my next lecture. Okay, so far I've only compared the top 10 films every year, but you can actually also look at longer periods. So what I did, I went through lots of figures and everything, and I tried to calculate the top grossing films for longer periods of time, for 1990 to 2004. So the first 15 years of the reunified Germany, roughly. And I tried to compare what are the biggest hits in the United States during that whole period, adjusted for inflation, and what are the biggest hits in terms of ticket sales in Germany. Okay, what did I find? Well, both lists feature the romantic epics Titanic, by far the most popular film in both markets, and Forrest Gump. And I would see Forrest Gump as a romantic film. I think it's quite important, although there's other ways in which you can look at it. They also, both charts, feature a number of animated science fiction, fantasy, and action films, especially action films with strong romantic storylines. Yet unlike the American-Canadian list, the German one also includes the straightforwardly romantic imports Pretty Woman, The Bodyguard, and What Women Want. So these are three romantic imports that do extremely well in Germany amongst the top grossing films of that period, but not at all in America to the same extent. The same is true for the sex comedies American Pie and American Pie 2. Don't forget, the Germans have this thing about erotic films. And usually, I mean, often these films are actually comedic, have been since the late 60s. So American Pie and American Pie 2 fit into this trend in Germany much better than they fit into their performance or into the preferences of American audiences. Now, by contrast, films featuring classic American comic strip characters do much better in their domestic market than in Germany. So in the American top grossing films for 1990-2004, you find Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2, and How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which is based on a classic American source, classic American novel, children's novel. But you don't find these films, which are based on classic comic strips or classic American novels, in the equivalent German chart. And if you do the comparison between these, the domestic chart and the foreign chart in general, you find the same. That things which are specifically American in terms of being based on comic strips from the 30s, 40s, or 50s, being based on classic American children's novels, and so on, that these things are much less likely to reproduce their success in the rest of the world. Because they are, even after all these decades of Americanization, they're still too specifically American to repeat the same level of success. Furthermore, the German list for the period 1990 to 2004 is much more biased towards English material than the American-Canadian list. And that also applies to this list. Now, there's a good reason for that. I mean, I have this theory that really popular culture is still, and cinema culture around the world, is still drawing perhaps on cultural traditions to do with the British Empire. And I have my suspicion about the whole Harry Potter phenomenon. I mean, that is just British public schools dressed up in the guise of magicians and such. So I think there's a whole reason why British material is not only so successful in Germany, but is successful everywhere in the world, including the United States, and that Hollywood draws increasingly on English material to distribute its films around the world, to make them successful around the world. I think that has a lot to do with the legacies of the British Empire, but I don't really know much about this yet, but I'm working on it. So watch this space. So if we look at the top grossing films in Germany, you know, the really, really top grossing films of those 15 years, films which you find nowhere near, nowhere near the same kind of position, ranking, in the American chart. The British slapstick comedy Bean, one of Germany's most popular films in those 15 years. But also, and I've already mentioned that, the Harry Potter films are very popular in Germany. Now, they're also popular in the United States, but not to the same extent. Also, the Lord of the Rings trilogy ranks much higher in that German chart than it does in the American chart. And again, I think that has a lot to do with a preference. All other things being equal, I'm not sure whether I would say a preference, but there may even be a preference for British material in Germany than for American material. So that a lot of the things that are actually Germany, that are a lot of Hollywood films that are successful in Germany, are actually British sourced, British themed, and so on. Okay, the most obvious difference between the list of the most popular films in Germany and the US and Canada is, not surprisingly, the German element in the German list. The top 30 films for 1990 to 2004 include the German-themed Hollywood import Schindler's List, as well as the German comedies Der bewegte Mann, Der Schuh des Manitou, Manitou's Shoe, Goodbye Lenin, Traumschiff Surprise, Periode 1, Dreamship Surprise, Period 1. Now, these are parodies of Star Trek and such. And Manitou's Shoe is a parody of Karl May movies. And then Sieben Zwerge, Männer allein im Wald, which I think is Otto again, which is an adaptation of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So the most striking difference, of course, between the American list of the top 30 movies of 1990 to 2004 and the German list is, of course, that there's German films about German subject matter with German comedians or German Nazis saving Jews in the German list, but not in the American list. This demonstrates that even in the new millennium, individual German productions, especially those featuring TV comedians, have been perfectly able to compete with Hollywood imports in the German market, not anywhere else, in the German market, as had been the case, for example, with the chart-topping Otto films and Männer in the 1980s. So there's always waves of films, cycles of films, in which the Germans can reassert their dominance at the German box office with individual films per year. They never can take over the whole top 10, but they always have individual films, in particular comedies, featuring TV comedians, which can top the charts and beat all the American competition. Now, this would seem to suggest that in other countries, even those that have a preponderance of Hollywood imports in their annual charts, we may also find that the top grossing films of recent years include a small number of domestic productions. I'm not sure whether anyone is doing this kind of work. I know it's done for Turkey, France. I'm not sure whether it's done for the Czech Republic. But amongst all these Hollywood, you know, blockbusters that dominate the charts, every year or two, there's a domestic production which beats all the competition. I'm not sure whether that's the case here as well, but it is certainly the case in Germany. It's certainly the case in Britain, France, Italy, Japan. Certainly in Japan, Miyazaki constantly breaks box office records with his animated films. In other words, audiences in different countries still make distinctive film choices, even though they may often share a strong preference for Hollywood. So even if a country or a whole set of countries is completely dominated by Hollywood films, which create most of the chart hits, the audience in this country still makes distinctive choices, not only for domestic productions, but also, for example, as in Germany, selecting sexually explicit material more regularly than the Americans would do in their own market. Now, after having examined the presence of Hollywood films in Germany, I now want to examine the presence of German filmmakers in Hollywood. This part is called The Displaced Patriotism of Wolfgang Petersen and Roland Emmerich. How are we doing with time? We're doing fine. I'm sorry about this whole discussion thing. It was a good idea, but I get too excited. Okay. So I'm now reversing the perspective. Not Hollywood in Germany or in the rest of the world, but Germans in Hollywood. Looking at Wolfgang Petersen and Roland Emmerich. The box office currency of German history, and that's a reference to the fact that if you want to sell a German film abroad, you have two strategies to do that. You can disguise the fact that it's a German film. That's the best strategy. No one wants to see German films, except, you know, art house audiences in the late 70s. No one wants to see German films. So what you do is you disguise that they're German films. Yeah. So you adapt The Name of the Rose with a French director, a British-American, French-Italian cast, shot God knows where. No one has any idea that that's a German movie. And of course, that is the key strategy of the leading German producer called Bernd Eichinger. He has made all these films. Curiously, they're never successful in the States, but they are grossing, you know, tens of millions of dollars around the world. But you would never know that they're German films because they're just made by foreigners based on foreign material. So that's one strategy. If you don't adopt that strategy, how do you sell a German film abroad? What can you market about Germany? Well, the Nazis, of course. Of course you make films about the World War II era or the Nazis. So I actually checked which films grossed most money from German imports, German language imports in the States, films where you knew they were German. They were not disguised as anything else. And from the, I looked at the 10 top grossing films from the mid 70s to the early 2000s. And with two exceptions, I think they were all about the Nazi era or its aftermath. Or, and that's interesting, about post-war division of Germany. That's the only other marketable theme that the Germans have. Yeah, Goodbye Lenin and The Lives of Others. Those are two films which also did quite well. I only checked for America. I didn't check for the rest of the world. So if you are a German filmmaker based in Germany, wanting to make a German language film about a German topic, and you want to sell it abroad, make it about the Nazis. Or try German division, try the wall. Those are the only two chances, at least as far as I can see, as far as the American market is concerned. But I think it's probably true for the rest of the world as well. Now, this box office currency, and we already realized that it's also a huge box office currency in Germany as well. We said that there was one wave from 77 to the early 80s, where a lot of films, both from Germany and from abroad, dealt with the World War II era and the Nazi period. So the box office currency of German history provided Wolfgang Petersen with his international breakthrough when his 1981 adaptation of Lothar Günther Buchheim's autobiographical bestseller, Das Boot, which the Americans always pronounce in the English as the boot, which means, what does that mean? It means, well, it means, you know, a certain type of shoe, but it's called Das Boot or the boat, not the boot. So this adaptation of a German bestseller, Das Boot, became the highest grossing German language film of all time in the US. So it beats, you know, Caligari, Metropolis, everything, all the Fassbender stuff, everything was beaten by quite a long margin, although I couldn't adjust the figures for inflation and exchange rate fluctuation, but it was beaten by quite a large margin. Das Boot becomes, in 1982-83, the highest grossing German language import in the United States. Now, the film's treatment of German history was widely perceived to be problematic. Yeah, it's not straightforward to do this whole selling Nazis to the world business. It's not unproblematic. And it was problematic both in West Germany and in the US, but more problematic in West Germany. That's something I'm going to come to in a minute. Buchheim, the author, and various German film critics, especially from upmarket papers, attacked the film Das Boot for what they perceived to be its betrayal of the book's anti-war message. They thought the film, unlike the novel, celebrated warriordom. That these, you know, German soldiers were, you know, good fighters, and the film celebrated them. And they found the upmarket critics found that utterly appalling. In the US, the film was largely celebrated as a highly accomplished action-oriented war movie. A classic variation of big-budget Hollywood genre cinema. So the German critics, especially the upmarket critics, saw the film as a betrayal of the book's anti-war message. The Americans saw it as a variation on classic American Hollywood big-budget action cinema. That's what they saw Das Boot as. The film went on to receive 6 Oscar nominations, including one for Best Director. So Petersen was up against, what was the, I can't remember what the year was exactly. Was it 83 or 82? But in any case, he was up against, you know, the leading directors in America. And I don't think a German director working in Germany has received an Oscar nomination. I can't think of anyone ever. I mean, this is for Best Director, not for Best Foreign Language Film, for Best Director. Now, despite this acceptance of the film, as basically, that's like Hollywood. Okay, they talk German. Then, of course, they rectified that because quite unusually for America, after sort of art house release, they did re-release it in an English dubbed version. So then, you know, it was even more like a Hollywood movie. But that was the main reception. It's just one of our own movies. Happens to be made by a German, about Germans, in Germany. But it's like one of our own. But there was also a little bit of concern. While generally accepting the film as a Hollywood genre movie, reviewers also mentioned that American cinema-goers might well find it difficult, I quote, to empathize utterly with the German crew during the last clear-cut war. That's interesting, you know, like, okay, Vietnam didn't turn out so well, that wasn't so good, Korea, nah. But World War II, I mean, we're sure about that, and we're sure that the Nazis were the bastards. You know, there's absolutely no doubt about this. We were right, they were wrong, that's it. So one of the reviewers for an American newspaper said, well, cinemagoers might find it difficult that the film invites or forces them to identify with the German crew. And they continue to write, you never forget that men like these sank hundreds of ships and killed thousands of men. I mean, of course, that's what soldiers do. That's the whole point of being a soldier. But of course, what he means, American men or our allies, these German bastards. Another reviewer commented, while the movie's anti-chauvinist tone was to be welcomed, there was also, I quote, a suspicion of narrative whitewash at work, exonerating its characters from Nazihood. So there was a concern amongst American critics that maybe the film didn't foreground enough that these weren't just soldiers, they were Nazi soldiers. That the film was whitewashing the soldiers from their affiliation with a criminal regime. Both in the US and in Germany, then, there was considerable concern about the legitimacy of this German movie about heroic Nazis. Indeed, 15 years later, Petersen was still upset about the film's German reception. "I was accused of having made a patriotic pro-war movie. That did hurt." And of course, he never came back after he left Germany for America. He really feels uncomfortable about certain aspects of the way he's treated in Germany and his films are treated. By this time, 15 years after the success of and the controversy around Das Boot, Petersen had become one of Hollywood's top directors. I mean, he's one of the most consistently successful directors in Hollywood over the last few decades. And he had achieved this, somewhat ironically, you might say, by making patriotic movies. American patriotic movies. Not German patriotic movies, American patriotic movies. Already, now, there's certainly an element of chance in any filmmaker's career. So, you know, sometimes when you trace a filmmaker's career, you're looking for these developments, and surely there's an element of chance, because most projects that filmmakers work on never get made. So whatever gets made is partly made by pure chance. Nevertheless, it is actually quite striking that if you look at the films that Petersen did make, that there's a clear trajectory from the Boot, Das Boot onwards. He moves away from specifically German subject matter, and indeed he moves away from Germany, and he moves towards all American material and towards California. That's a clear trajectory after Das Boot. Already his next film, The Neverending Story, which was another German bestseller adaptation, was a big budget English language film. Das Boot was shot in German, but then was dubbed on its second release in the United States. The Neverending Story was an English language film, which was made in Germany, but set in New York. And American reviewers treated this film, by and large, as yet another Hollywood blockbuster. There was really no recognition in the reviews that I read that this had anything to do with Germany. Although it was a German bestseller, made by a German filmmaker, largely in Germany, but it was set in America, and it was just seen as another E.T.-type movie. There was no recognition that this was a foreign film. Whether they liked it or not, these reviewers, and many of them didn't like it when compared to E.T., they did not see anything particularly German in this film. Interestingly, The Neverending Story earned about twice as much as Das Boot in the U.S. It wasn't a German language film. It was even more than Das Boot perceived as just another Hollywood movie, and it earned about twice as much as the highest grossing German language film in the United States ever. It also was the top grossing film in West Germany in 1984. While the science fiction movie Enemy Mine in 1985 was a flop, it was the first of Petersen's films produced by a major Hollywood studio. Although it was still shot in Europe, you can see how this moves. Making German finance films in Germany about German books. Making German finance films in Germany, adapting a German language book, but in English, with an English lead actor. Making a science fiction film, more sort of American genre, I guess, in some ways, in Europe, but for a major Hollywood studio. So this is the trajectory of his career. Next, Petersen went to Los Angeles, so he goes to California, to direct the thriller Shattered, based on an American novel, but it's a German-American co-production. So it's still not fully Hollywood. It's a German-American co-production. Despite this film's failure at the box office, it got him the assignment to direct Clint Eastwood's In the Line of Fire, 1992. Now, this is a thriller about a Secret Service agent who gets the chance to redeem himself for his failure to prevent the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and he can redeem himself by foiling an attempt on the life of the current president. Only a minor hit in Germany, it earned $103 million at the US box office, and it was just outside the top 10. Now, let's look at this film. How did American reviewers look at this Clint Eastwood Wolfgang Petersen movie? They were, on the whole, very enthusiastic about the film, noting that Petersen had a very particular sensitivity, I quote, to the look and feel of American politics. So they did register that this was a foreigner, but they said, hey, he really gets American politics right, what it feels like, what it looks like. And they also celebrated his professionalism and his understanding of genre. Indeed, the old-fashioned qualities of In the Line of Fire seem to be so out of keeping with much of contemporary Hollywood cinema that Newsweek, the American magazine, wondered whether it takes a German director to make a movie in the classical Hollywood style these days. Yeah, so his Germanness was something which, okay, it could be a problem if he gets the look and feel of American politics wrong, but he doesn't. And then it becomes an advantage because American filmmakers are so alienated from their society that they can't make, and they're so ambitious and pretentious that they can't make a good old-fashioned Hollywood action movie anymore. So you need a German coming in to make this kind of movie. Perhaps most importantly, the film was seen primarily as a meditation on Eastwood's star image. So it really wasn't what you think, it's about John F. Kennedy or whatever. It's actually, what the critics at least thought, it was a meditation on Eastwood's star image. It's not about Kennedy, it was about Clint Eastwood. By contrast, German reviewers tended to see In the Line of Fire as a Wolfgang Petersen film, not as a Clint Eastwood film. And they saw it primarily not as a genre film, an action film, but as a meditation on American history. A film about political trauma, namely the Kennedy assassination. Now, critics might lament the fact that Petersen was and had always been an artisan rather than an artist. He was not an auteur, he was a craftsman. And the German highbrow critics, at least, thought that was bad. Yet, these same critics who complained that he wasn't a true artist also expressed a certain pride in his achievement. I quote from a subheadline of one of the articles, "A German successful in Hollywood." That was the pitch. You know, one of us is successful in Hollywood. And readers of this particular article were reminded of the famous exiles of the past. So Petersen was put in the tradition of the great German filmmakers working in Hollywood across the 20th century. But he was denied the status of an artist. That was bad. But that he's one of us in Hollywood, that was good. There was agreement that the film, which was released in Germany with the title The Second Chance, not In the Line of Fire, but The Second Chance, that this film was about the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination, about American national decline and redemption. One reviewer noted the nice irony, that's a German reviewer, that of all people it was a German who, I quote, gave the Americans the definitive thriller about their political drama. Americans are not very good with political drama. Germans, we're very good with political drama. So it stands to reason for this critic to say that this is the definitive thriller about the Kennedy assassination, which is an extraordinary thing to say for a German critic. But then he says, and it, of course it takes a German to make that film, because the Americans are too dumb or too superficial to do that. We Germans, we know about political trauma. Another reviewer suggested that the film served, and that's interesting, German fantasies. The film wasn't at all about Kennedy. Actually, it was about German fantasies, about their own history. Fantasies which could not be indulged in German movies. And I quote, "The thesis of this film is that history can be rewritten. Mistakes can be erased. It would have been impossible to make this film in Germany." Of course the Germans want to erase their history, but they're sort of, you know, deep enough to know that they shouldn't really do that. But Petersen going to America, he can make a film about Kennedy which expresses the German fantasy that you get a second chance, that you can erase the mistakes of your past, as if Hitler and the Nazi regime and the Holocaust had never happened. That's how German critics read In the Line of Fire, where American critics saw a German professional making a Hollywood action movie. The German critics see a German filmmaker informed by political drama in Germany fantasizing about the erasure of the political past. After the medical thriller Outbreak in 1995, which was a substantial international hit, which was also the 10th highest grossing film of 1995 in Germany, Petersen made another thriller revolving around an American president. In Air Force One 1997, the president is taken hostage on his plane together with his wife and daughter, and he forgoes the chance to escape so as to save his family. That's basically Air Force One. American reviewers, which again refer to Peterson as a highly competent genre specialist, just a professional, a true professional, American reviewers noted that presidents were currently fashionable at the movies, that none was deemed anywhere near as admirable as Harrison Ford's mixture of, I quote, superhero and super statesman in Air Force One. By and large, critics succumbed to Ford's star appeal and found the stark contrast between this fantasy president and his real-life counterparts, from Reagan via Bush to Bill Clinton. They found that contrast amusing rather than worrying or objectionable. Those are American critics. German reviewers, as you can imagine, responded very differently. First of all, they took Air Force One very, very seriously. Condescendingly, they assumed that due to the, I quote, naive patriotism of Americans, the film and its US reception were, I quote, completely free of irony. So they make this big assumption about that Americans, of course, are idiots. They wouldn't know irony if it hit them in the face. So obviously they take this film completely literal. Whereas, as I said, the American reviewers saw it in a very, very a playful way. And I would think that similar things might be true for the actual American audience. German critics described Air Force One as, I quote, a fantasy of omnipotence for barmaids in Atlanta. I'm not sure how offensive can you be as a critic, but that's what they wrote. A fantasy of omnipotence for barmaids in Atlanta. Barmaids being uneducated, Atlanta being in the South, you know, all the worst things about America. And of course, that's what they thought the film was all about, to serve the fantasy of simple-minded Americans. Simple-minded reactionary Americans. Unlike their American colleagues, most German critics described the film as patriotic. The Americans didn't actually talk about whether the film was patriotic or not, but the Germans thought the film was very patriotic, which I take to mean that they interpreted the film's celebration of its presidential hero as an expression of love for the country he represents. So I think that's what they meant by that. If you portray a president as a positive figure, as a hero, then by implication you celebrate the country he represents. That's what the German critics thought the film was doing. Some went further by pointing out that the film was more patriotic than Hollywood's regular output, linking its super patriotism to its German director. Yeah. So they say, not only is this a patriotic movie celebrating America, but it's actually more patriotic than most American films, and that has something to do with the fact that it has a German director. Now, this theme of the super patriotism of Wolfgang Petersen was established early on when the Frankfurter Rundschau reported on the film's American release under the headline, "The Patriotism of Immigrants." That was the headline when they reported on the release of Air Force One in the United States. Therefore, suggesting that Petersen was not only in love with America, but also used Hollywood to project a specifically German fantasy. Now, what is this fantasy? That not on, and I quote from the article, that not only our leaders, and don't forget that the American word leader, the original in German is Führer. Yeah, so they had a lot of fun, these writers, to say, now, to just express their worry about this film. But now not as, you know, the stupidity of barmaids in Atlanta, but somehow this is too German for us, because this really is about a Führer. You know, this film celebrates a Führer. Oh God, you know, we can't have that. So, the critics claim that Petersen's film expresses a German fantasy, and I said that they did the same with In the Line of Fire. It's not about Kennedy and America. It's actually about the Germans. It's about German history. Not only can our... Okay, it's the fantasy that not only our leaders, but also our fathers might be heroes and all of us innocent. That's the fantasy that they claimed the film Air Force One expressed. Noting that American directors were more likely to portray the president as an unscrupulous scoundrel, Die Welt quoted Newsweek's statement that it took a German-born director to bring to the screen a creature that we Americans can barely imagine, a president as hero. So it's very complicated here. Newsweek says American directors don't make films like this anymore. But the Germans come in and, you know, they can give us something we need. But the German critics are worried about this because they think that if a German makes a positive film about an American president, they really try to redeem Hitler. And that's how the German audience will respond to the film. You can see how political trauma goes very deep into German film culture here. In an interview, now, obviously, the problem is that Pedersen said, yeah, you're probably right. In an interview with the conservative daily, Die Welt, Pedersen was upfront about his investment in the patriotism of Air Force One. He presented himself as a typical German, and he said, after the war, we Germans were not allowed to display patriotic feelings. We were not allowed to do this. To admit that we loved our countries. You know, someone has forbidden us to love our country. Now, it was nice for me to get my share of good patriotic feelings through making Air Force One. Feelings that I have never had before. So, obviously, it doesn't help the paranoia of the critics that Pedersen says these things in public and probably means them too. Yeah, he says, isn't it great that, you know, I always have to feel guilty about being German and I certainly can't love my country, but as soon as I go to America, I can love America and I can make films about the love of the country and I can make films about glorious leaders and I don't have to be ashamed of it, except if my film is shown in Germany, where the critics will discover what I'm doing and tell me off about it. And I think we're not surprised that he never returns to Germany to make films there and live there. Pedersen's statement implied that viewing his film offered his fellow Germans the same release of repressed patriotic feelings that he himself had felt making it. Yeah? That's what his statement implies. I want all Germans to feel patriotic for something. And even if it is America. Because they need it. Because they have been denied patriotism after World War II. It is tempting then to link the film's success in Germany to its ability to vent German patriotism. In fact, however, because these arguments never work quite as beautifully as you want them to, Air Force One was only ranked 16th for the year and thus did not do as well in Germany as its much less patriotic predecessor, Outbreak. The film's German box office performance was also a disappointment in relation to its extraordinary success in the US, with box office revenues of $173 million, and elsewhere in the world, where it earned $142 million. So in actual fact, although you think, the Germans want to vent their repressed patriotism, Air Force One does that, they will make this into a mega hit. No, they didn't. They liked it much less than, comparatively speaking, the rest of the world did, and certainly than Americans did. Air Force One did not find as big an audience in Germany as one might have expected. Perhaps the obvious disdain that critics showed for Pedersen's and the film's patriotism indicates that even when channeled through representations of another country, Germans are not perfectly at ease with their patriotic feelings. As soon as anything is patriotic, for whatever country whatsoever, they might say, no. You might think that. Maybe that's one of the reasons. If this is indeed the case, then the success of Independence Day demonstrate that this unease with patriotism can be overcome. German reviews of Air Force One often refer to Independence Day from the previous year. Independence Day, of course, features another American president who turns into an action hero. And the people who accused Air Force One of displaced German patriotism used the same arguments about Independence Day. Only a German would make such a patriotic movie. Now, ever since attending film school in Munich, Roland Emmerich had single-mindedly worked in the science fiction genre, writing and directing four films in Germany in the 1980s, all of which were co-produced by his own company, Centropolis. The last three of these films were shot in English, and Emmerich came to be known in Germany as Spielbergler, which is a diminutive of Spielberg, Little Spielberg. In the 1990s, Emmerich took his production company and many of his German collaborators. It's quite extraordinary. He just decamps from Germany and takes, you know, his sister, you know, his special effects team, God knows who else, and relocates to California and continues making science fiction films. His Hollywood debut, Universal Soldier, 1992, which was actually a piece of work where he proved he could do a spectacular action film fairly cheaply. That's what the purpose of this film was. He had no other investment in this except to show he could do it. From then on, he has co-written and produced all of his films with his own people. Yeah, he has long-term collaborators. Initially, it was, forgot the name now, but he has these long-term collaborators, both Germans and Americans. He has this team, and he obsessively makes these science fiction films. He probably has, a tighter control or a closer network of friends and collaborators than any other filmmaker in Hollywood. And he has done this since the 90s. And some of these people, he worked with in the 80s in Germany. So Universal Soldier, which was just this proof that he can do a big budget, a spectacular action film at a reasonable price, was followed in 1994 by Stargate, which was his first major hit, which earned $120 million outside the US and became the fifth highest grossing film of the year in Germany, much more successful than it was in the States. Then came the mega hit Independence Day, which, like Stargate, was co-written by Emmerich. The film became the sixth highest grossing film of all time in the US, if we don't take into account inflation, with domestic revenues of $306 million, and the second highest grossing film of all time outside the US. It's not adjusted for inflation or ticket price fluctuation, but it was the second highest grossing film of all time outside the US, with foreign revenues of $505 million. Unlike Air Force One, it was also a huge hit in Germany. As the year's top grossing movie, Independence Day sold almost 70% more tickets in Germany than its nearest competitor. 70% more tickets than its nearest competitor. Now, American critics saw Independence Day as a mixture of genre cliches and film references. Some worried about the film's nostalgia for Cold War certainties and macho heroics and its cheerful insistence on stereotyping, which is very amusing in some way, that you don't get many stereotypically Jewish characters in American movies after the 70s, except for Woody Allen films. But in big budget movies, you rarely get a stereotypical Jewish character. Along comes this German filmmaker, and you have the most ridiculously stereotypical, Jewish father figure in Independence Day that you can imagine. It is quite extraordinary, and the Americans felt that doesn't feel right. That somehow doesn't feel right that this German filmmaker gives us these ridiculous stereotypes, including, it's a very sympathetic stereotype, but it's still a massive Jewish stereotype, the father of the Jeff Goldblum character. Judd Hirsch, I think, is the actor. However, most American critics liked the film, despite some concerns, precisely because it did not take itself too seriously. That's what they liked most about the film. They said it gave the audience plenty of witty winks and nods, and it was altogether bubbly, sweet-natured, and spirit-lifting. So that's what American critics liked about the film. Almost all agreed that Independence Day is undeniably fun. Predictably, the German press did not agree. They highlighted both Emmerich's involvement, so a lot of the reviews were about Emmerich, and they highlighted the film's patriotism. So I quote from one review: "Since John Wayne saddled his horse and rode into the sunset, there has been no American film more patriotic than Independence Day." At the same time, relating Emmerich's success to that of Petersen, critics began to speak of a German conquest of Hollywood. That's another favorite theme. I have found it in myself as well. As soon as you find a few prominent Germans somewhere, you talk about a German conquest. It seems to be also something very built into the German character or fantasy life. So on the one hand, they say, isn't this appalling that these German filmmakers go to Hollywood and make what, in the judgment of some left-liberal highbrow critics, were proto-fascist movies? Isn't that, problematic? Isn't that embarrassing? At the same time, they're very proud that the Germans conquer Hollywood. It is really, it's really fun to read these reviews. So this idea of a German conquest of Hollywood culminated 4 years later when, in the wake of the worldwide success of Petersen's Air Force One in 1997 and Emmerich's Godzilla, you always hear that Godzilla was a flop. It wasn't. It was a massive hit outside the United States. When after the success of those two films, the 4th of July weekend, remember, this is not an American holiday anymore. This is, you know, a global holiday. Today is our Independence Day. So on the 4th of July weekend in 2000, two films were released simultaneously. Pedersen's bestseller adaptation, The Perfect Storm, and Emery's epic about the American Revolution, The Patriot. German headlines announced. On Independence Day, there's a showdown between German directors in US cinemas. Battle of the Teutons. Are German directors better US patriots? And thanks to Germany, Hollywood imports patriotism and war. There's a sense of pride and concern about these. Can you see? Like, oh, finally we're going to take over something again. We're going to invade something, we're going to take it over. But it is a bit problematic and embarrassing, really. While critical judgments about the two films, and of course Patriot is an extraordinary film. It's a blood and soil. It is a politically very problematic. It's about blood, defending blood and soil and giving it, sacrificing everything for it. And it also has a scene in it which is a documented German war crime which is projected onto the English, you know, driving people into a church and burning them alive, that is not documented from the War of Independence at all, but it's very well documented with Nazi war crimes in Europe. And he includes that in the film. You think, ah, you know, you could have avoided that, Roland. You know, that wasn't necessary. Okay, while critical judgments about the two films were largely negative, there's a strong hint in these deadlines that I read of vicarious enjoyment of the reputed German takeover of American cinema, a sense of pride of the two filmmakers' achievements and power, and also perhaps relief about the fact that German patriotism was safely vented through Hollywood movies. Because I think the critics might be worried about all this proto-fascist stuff, but they're very happy that it happens harmlessly through Hollywood movies rather than joining a neo-fascist organization in Germany or something like that. So there's a sense of relief as well. These are just movies, and if these problematic Germans, who we can't trust, you know, we Germans intellectuals can't trust all these simple Germans, they're basically fascists, but as long as they vent their fascism through Hollywood movies, then maybe we won't have, you know, another, you know, Nazi party. Thus, Hollywood has provided German directors like Pedersen and Emmerich with the opportunity to idolize national leaders in their films, and thus to vent their suppressed patriotism through American stories. By and large, American critics have seen their films as effective genre cinema. By contrast, the German press frequently has discussed these films in political terms, condemning the presumed naivety and arrogance of Americans, as well as the latent nationalism and indeed fascism of Germans. At the same time, critics appear to acknowledge that films provide a safe outlet for what they see as problematic feelings. Okay. Conclusion. Despite the almost complete takeover of West German box office charts by Hollywood since the 1970s and the departure of many leading German filmmakers to Hollywood in the 1980s, the choices made by German cinema audiences and filmmakers have remained distinctive. For example, there's a significant demand in Germany for films about the Nazi era and World War II. A closer analysis of the box office charts in Germany than I was able to do today would reveal that about every 20 years there's a cycle of top 10 hits on these themes. Every 20 years. It's almost like every generation has to go to the cinema and watch Nazi movies. You know, and then it dies down a little bit, and then 20 years later they come back. It's an amazing regularity. And these movies about World War II and the Nazi era tend to comprise both domestic productions and Hollywood imports. At the same time, of all German productions which do not disguise their country of origin by being shot in English with an international cast and largely non-German character settings and source material, the most famous example being The Name of the Rose, those dealing with the Nazi era and its aftermath appear to have the best chance to succeed abroad, especially in the US, and the recent example would be Downfall. It is too early to say whether the recurring references to the country's post-war division, both in domestic and in export hits, such as Goodbye Lenin and The Lives of Others, will gain the same prominence as the extensive exploration of the Nazi past. You know, will that become the same cycle, that every 20 years we get a series of very successful German-produced films about the German division, which will be successful both in Germany and abroad? It seems clear, however, that even those German filmmakers who moved to Los Angeles cannot escape the pull of 20th century German history. Certainly, many of the Hollywood blockbusters made by Wolfgang Petersen and Roland Emmerich have been received in the German press as an indirect engagement with German history. And Petersen has, as we've heard, freely admitted that he has released what he describes as his suppressed German patriotism, suppressed because of past Nazi crimes, through patriotic American movies. Thus, I want to suggest that our ongoing debates about the causes and consequences of Hollywood's ever more comprehensive conquest of global markets should perhaps consider that this is not a one-way process. As much as Hollywood is exploiting cultural resources and markets around the globe, it is in turn being used for their own purposes by filmmakers and audiences from all over the world. It's a two-way street. It isn't just Hollywood exploiting, people exploit Hollywood. Emmerich and Petersen certainly do. I also want to suggest, with particular reference to the previous lecture, that we need to be very careful whenever we are talking about Hollywood's global audience. We need to learn much more about the presence of Hollywood films in those countries in which most of the world's population lives, notably China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Russia, which between them have had half of the world's population in 2004. These are also the countries in which most, by far, the majority of film viewing activity on this planet takes place. So I think whenever I talk about global, or anyone else talks about Hollywood's global reach, you really have to ask, what about these countries? What do we really know about Hollywood's presence in these countries? Almost all of these markets have only generated a tiny portion of Hollywood's overall income, and Hollywood films in turn have probably had only a small, even negligible presence in most of these countries. Finally, I think we always need to remind ourselves that the film success at the American box office does not always translate straightforwardly into success abroad. Both the export market as a whole, perceived in terms of financial returns rather than in terms of ticket sales, and individual countries are characterized by distinctive hit patterns. No matter how much Hollywood dominates, it dominates differently in each country. It is, I think, worth asking why this is so. Why do these very, very distinctive patterns, which are an expression, I think, of differences in preferences and perhaps values and ideals, why does this persist? And what does it tell us about cultural differences between the populations of different countries? Differences which have by no means disappeared, although they may well have been getting smaller all the time in recent decades. They have not disappeared despite an almost century-long campaign of so-called Americanization. And as I said in my previous lecture, I actually think we should get rid of the term Americanization altogether. Because Americanization would mean that countries like the Czech Republic or Germany would gradually get more support in this in their populations for the death penalty and would become fundamentalistically or at least passionately religious. And I don't think we see any evidence of that at all. So I think we should even abandon the whole concept of Americanization. But that's something that is not really of relevance right now. So thank you very much. Once again, there's no time for discussion. I don't know why this happens, because, you know, it's only 18 pages, and you think, well, I take 2.5 minutes per page. That leaves, you know, half an hour at the end, but somehow it doesn't. Anyway, thank you very much. I see you tomorrow in the other room.